Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. I've been a member of Sabre since 1987. It's the first time I've done a presentation. And I think like probably all of you in the room, it was very humbling at the awards banquet. I met some of the people whose years and years, lifetime of research have benefited me. And again, it's just, I love these conventions. I've been to a number of them, not nearly as many as some of you, but what I wanted to do today, I wanted to talk a little bit about a team that all of you know about, but maybe not so much about one of the individual players. And when I taught college students for 38 years, I, in addition to teaching U.S. history courses, I taught Iowa history courses. And one of the things you find out is how little Iowans knew about their own state. And I used to have fun with my students the first day of class. I'd offer an A if they could name the first governor of Iowa. I didn't ever give an A away. And I think the same thing, when it comes to baseball history. In your program, it says that in the last 4.5 years since I retired that I've done, I did my 70th program the other day. And part of that is to try to fix that. I want to, I've spoken to a lot of different groups, libraries, retired groups, and so on, but educate them a little bit about, baseball history and also about Sabre. So today, I'd like to talk about Calvin Elitena today and start out with a picture near the end of his career. As he approached the end of his player-manager days with the Cincinnati Reds in 1878-79, many people weren't, and still aren't, aware of the trail that he blazed as one of baseball's true pioneers. What I'd like to do is I'd like to look at some of the things during his career, both baseball-related and just simply on a personal level. But he was the first professional baseball player born west of the Mississippi River. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Montrose, Iowa. I've been down there a number of times in the last 10 years. And I had to literally make the town, it's been there for, 1848 or 49, shortly after Iowa became a state. And they weren't aware that the first professional player, we've had 221 from Iowa, 7 in the Hall of Fame, and they weren't aware that it all began with Calvin Bay, born in a little town 6 miles from the Keokuk. So in addition to being born west of the Mississippi, the first, he was the youngest player in professional baseball when he was signed. His father, William, had to sign his 1869 Red Stockings contract because he was only 18, not of legal age at that time in Ohio. And I think it's pretty astonishing when you think about it. He was hired, at $800 for the season. And if you look at the average salary of a family in America at that time in 1869, it was less than $400. And this was a kid that loved baseball. We'll talk a little bit about his early career and so on. He was the youngest player manager in professional baseball in 1873 with the Baltimore Canaries, also called the Lord Baltimores, or the Baltimore Yellow Stockings. And I thought about entitling my program Red Stockings, White Stockings, Yellow Stockings in Calvin Bay, but he also did play with the Reds. In the National Association, he led the National Association hits and runs scored in 1874. His 5-year 362 batting average ranked second to Ross Barnes, 379. And he ranked second in RBIs in the National Association in terms of their overall records. He was a key player on the inaugural National League Chicago White Sox teams in 1876-7 when they won the pennant in 76 with a 52-14 record. His fellow Lion, Cap Anson, was on that team. And of course, that team was made up of a number of those they were referred to as the notorious Big Four. McCrady was one of them, Ross Barnes, Ethan White, and Al Spalding. And again, Spalding would pitch to Calvin McVay, a pretty tough battery at the time. He played in one of the first professional baseball games in Iowa on June 10th, 1875. And it was a trip that the Boston Red Stockings had made to play against Iowa's first professional baseball team, the Keokuk Westerns. They were part of the association, and there had been an earlier game. Chicago had come and played against the Keokuk Westerns on May 4th of 1875. But in that game, the Boston team won 6-4, and McCray didn't have a very good game. He went over 2, he had 5 assists. The amazing thing is, when I read the newspaper accounts, that Keokuk is only 6 miles from there, from Montrose, Iowa, where he was born. And as you go through there and read about the first ball game, you know, the first ball game he played in Iowa, he's not mentioned. It was really the return of the native son to Iowa. He would make a couple trips back, you know, after he left at an early age. He was instrumental in spreading the game to the West Coast, San Francisco area first, and then to other California cities. First as an 1869 Red Sox player. He batted 680 in the six games that he played out there. He was 34-50, pretty good batting average. But they, and again, it wasn't really fair. They played two games each against a couple of the teams in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they, I think the total score was something like this in those games, 280-24 or something. It wasn't much of a contest. So, and as a player manager, from 1880 to 91, when he eventually left the Cincinnati Reds, he would go back out to California. He fell in love with the Bay Area. And he would be a player manager, first with the Oakland Bay City Athletics in 1880 to 1885, and then with the San Francisco Pioneers in 1885, followed by the San Diego Hamiltons from 1886 to 88, and finally with the San Jose Dukes in 1890-91. So his career spans being signed as an 18-year-old with Cincinnati in 1869 until he eventually retires. He's 41 years old when he eventually left the game of baseball. Another interesting fact about Calvin McVeigh, and I read this when I was trying to find information. It's really hard to find information about his growing up in Iowa, 11 years he was there. I have some, I'll talk a little bit about that. But throughout his career, he was very versatile. And they talk about him doing flip-flaps by the Keokuk Rapids when he was growing up. And he actually did, you know, Ozzie Smith flips during, you know, after games and so on. But long before Burt Campaneris and Cesar Tovar made headlines by playing all nine positions in a single game, McVeigh had played all the positions except pitcher by the age of 23. He would pitch and manage as well a little bit later. His versatility, and this is just, you know, interesting, in his major league years, he played 9 years as a catcher or a change catcher, as they referred to it. And a lot of times he numbered different positions during the season. He played first base five of different seasons that he played. He played second base two seasons. He played shortstop for one season. He played third base in seven seasons, the outfield seven seasons, and he pitched four seasons. And so a tremendously athletic guy. Some of the accounts that when he was in Boston, they talk about what a great pugilist he was. And there was a boxing coach in the Boston area that compared him to John Sullivan in terms of the power of his punch. He wasn't a real big guy, he was about my size. He was around 5'9 or 5'10. And I've seen him with different weights, it varies between 170 and 190. But apparently very athletic. So what you're looking at here is a picture at the end of his career in the majors with Cincinnati in the late 1870s, 78, 79. So like I said a few minutes ago, I've been there. And probably Montrose, it's not known for much, and it wasn't known for anything at all until I, you know, introduced them to their native son. But when you go to Montrose, they do have binoculars set up on the dock there, and you look at the temple built by the Mormons in Nauvoo. It's right across the river. And now, you know, we've had a couple of fundraising events down there when I did my presentation. We've been able to raise money for a plaque to the first major league player from Iowa, Calvin McVeigh. And that was just done this last year. But the Montrose itself, Iowa became a state in 1846, and Calvin McVeigh was born in 1849. His father, William, and his mother, Carolyn, had come there to homestead, and when he came to Iowa in his years, you could get basically an 80-acre farm for $1.25 an acre. And they settled about 2 or 3 miles northwest of the actual village of Montrose itself. His father was a carpenter. He tried to be a farmer. He wasn't very successful, so they struggled for about 11 years. And because of that, you know, they would end up heading back to Indianapolis. This is another just etching of Montrose along the Mississippi River. Keokuk is a critical city in Iowa history, and its nickname and the title of its newspaper to this day is a gay city. Because if you came to settle in Iowa by river, you had to come through Keokuk. It would be important during the Civil War and so on. And it has an interesting baseball history as well, having the first professional team there, the Westerns, the first professional black player and so on, and played in Keokuk and so on. But after frustrating 11 years, their family headed back to Indianapolis, where they had relatives and roots. And I just had a street scene of Indianapolis in the early 1870s, late 1860s, early 1870s. And Calvin himself, he would go over to the Northwestern Christian University, and he and a guy named George Sayer, they would play a game called Numbers. And as I read about, you know, how they played the game in a couple of accounts from the New York Journal, it was played a lot like a game that I and my three brothers grew up playing on a playground near our home. And most of you know, or you've heard of this game, it was either called Work Up or Work Ya. And as long as you could keep batting, three of you, you could stay up there forever. And one of the accounts says that they ruined the recess for all the other kids because they never got to bat. And he was good. And but anyway, in 1866, he was asked to join and play for the Northwestern Christian University Nine, which he did for part of a season. And then he joined the Westerns, one of the clubs there in Indianapolis. And there's an account in Spalding's 1911 book, Baseball of America's Game, of where the team from Washington with ringers had come to play against the Westerns, and Calvin McQuaid distinguished himself in that game, and it was noticed by some of the people. And that'll be important later when they actually, you know, hired him to play for the Cincinnati Red Sox. He finished with the Actors in 1868, and by that time had built up a reputation as a very good, versatile, all-around player. And most of you are familiar with the Peck and Snyder trade card, which some people refer to as the first baseball card, at least commercial baseball card, not necessarily a picture. But I do collect baseball cards, and when I do my presentations, I take around part of my collection, including this card. I have some other early items of Calvin McVay's in my collection. McVay is in the back row, second from the right, and this team, he was a key factor. And by, you know, a lot of accounts, he was one of the most powerful batters, and the statistics bear that out. And he'll play a critical role. Daryl Brock did an extensive bit of research to once and for all settle a dispute about what the record was in 1869. A lot of people had said 57-0 for years. In an article that appeared in Sabre some time ago, he said that because of how they logged some of these games and so on, it actually should be 60. And, you know, and then we'll talk about that, the Troy Haymakers game here in a minute and so on. But it should have been 60 victories. And then again, 24 more the next season before finally meeting the Brooklyn Atlantics in that summer of 1870. He plays a critical role in two of the most important games involving the Cincinnati Red Sox. The game with the Haymakers in 1869, he was the batter. When there was a disputed call in terms of the ball bouncing and the catcher at the time, you know, scooping up some dirt and basically saying he caught the ball, and the umpire said no, and the score was tied 17-17, and of course the Haymakers left the field and they had to forfeit the game. Other than that, they had a perfectly, you know, unblemished record in that first year. A couple of close games, but most of them are very lopsided. And then of course the next summer, when they went to the Brooklyn Atlantics undefeated, 10 or 15,000 people showed up, and Bob Ferguson was there, death-defying things and so on. And the game was an exciting game, a huge crowd, and it went into extra innings, and that ball finally decided the outcome of the game. It was hit over his head in right field, and for, again, a number of years, there was some dispute about the actions of the crowd. Did they open up for him? Did they close behind him so he couldn't get the throw back in? Did somebody jump on his back? Later in his life, he said, no, that clearly didn't happen, and so on. And the Red Sox accepted their defeat, and the streak was finally over. So McVay was involved in both those. A chromolithograph, I love this, the aesthetics of early baseball. And like I said, I collected these things. I've been a collector of baseball cards and memorabilia for over 60 years, and this is one of the most beautiful things. McVay is in the middle there with the bow tie, and then I think most of you know, after they've been on the road for almost a month, 21 games on the East Coast that 69 season, they came back and Aaron Champion, and they helped put the team together through a giant banquet, and they played some local games and so on. And one of the owners of a lumberyard in Cincinnati said that they deserved a trophy or an award worthy of the greatest team in America. And this 27-foot, 1,600-pound bat was given to them before they were set out for the rest of the season on their Western tour. That's actually from Harper's Weekly. And this, of course, appeared in one of the publications earlier. And since then, the birth date of McVeigh has been corrected. After the first two years at Cincinnati, Harry and George Wright, Charlie Gould, and Calvin McVeigh broke ranks. There were problems financially with Cincinnati and so on, and they were offered, you know, a better offer to go and play in Boston. And it should read 1849 there in terms of his birth year. The rest of the information on there is correct. But he would go to Boston and spend 1871, 72, playing in Boston. And the Mort Rogers programs are gorgeous, rare, expensive, but it's a nice depiction of Calvin McVeigh. That particular photograph, it comes in two styles, the block printing and the script under his name. And I've seen one at a national show, but another nice look at Calvin McVeigh. And then this is part of my collection. Many, many years ago here in Chicago, a longtime auction house dealer, most of you know his name, Bill Mastro. We worked out an arrangement where this became a permanent part of my collection. And I don't know, some of you that are authorities on autographs can correct me, but I know there are very, very few autographs of Calvin McVeigh. And this does appear on the back of this particular photograph. And this, of course, the Warren Studios in Boston, the second time he was in Boston, autographed on the back. And of course, the first position played was a change catcher and a right fielder. He started out right field, 1869, but by the end of his career, he played pretty much all the positions. After the first 2 years with Boston, he went to Baltimore, and I mentioned in my opening comments that he was the youngest player manager, and that was very brief. It was 23-14 record. He wasn't there for a full season, and then it would be back to Boston for two more years, and he would spend two more years with Boston. He was part of that group of American baseball players led by the Wrights, George and Harry, and of course they had that ongoing dispute with Henry Chadwick, Spalding and Chadwick, about the origins of the game. And so they agreed to take the game of baseball to England and Ireland to play a number of games on that tour. McVeigh went on that tour, and by all accounts, you know, he distinguished himself. They not only won the baseball games, which didn't surprise anybody, but then they also beat him in cricket, and which I think really embarrassed the British. But that was in 1874, and again, he's still a young kid to do all these things. A real treat, a real honor, and so on. After 2 years with Boston, he would come to Chicago. And in 1876 and 7, with the White Sox, in those 2 years, his batting average was .347, and then .368. In 1876, he pitched as well as batted. The .347, his pitching record was 5-2 with a 1.52 ERA. And that he played with Cap Anson. We're going to have a program later on Cap Anson in this Sabre session. And he had visited Chicago before he played for the White Stockings. Towards the end of the second season with the Cincinnati Red Stockings, there were two games that were played at the very end of the season. The first one, the Chicago White Stockings went to the Union Grounds, and that was on September 7th of 1870, about 5,000 fans, and Chicago beat the Cincinnati Red Stockings by a score of 10-6. They had lost a game to the Brooklyn Atlantic, so their record was not unblemished anymore, and they would end up losing a few more games. McVeigh got one hit in that game. Then there was basically a reciprocal game played here in Chicago. The rivalry was intense between Cincinnati and Chicago, and I think we're going to have a program later this afternoon with Bruce Allardyce about Cincinnati and Chicago. And it was partly a commercial rivalry, but it was also a rivalry over civic pride. The Cincinnati Centennial newspaper had said before the game, either city is too proud to lose a game in which so much of the city's pride is involved. And in that second game, it was played here in Chicago at Dexter Park on Thursday, October 13th, and a huge crowd. They said in one account, the largest crowd to ever see a game here in the West, 15,000 fans showed up. And it was a very close game for 9 innings. It was tied 8-8. And then Asa Brainerd basically blew up, and Harry Wright came in. They ended up losing 16-8, even though it was tied in the 9th inning. And again, McVay got one hit. When he leaves Chicago, the opening image you saw, he goes back to Cincinnati, and he was a player manager for 2 years in Cincinnati in 78 and 79. And they finished second the first year and fifth the second year. He had a tremendous career in a short period of time. When he had gone to the West Coast in that first 1869 tour, he fell in love with the Bay Area. And he had made up his mind that he was going to go out there to settle. So he went out there in 1880, and in the San Francisco Bay Area with the Athletics there and so on, the Bay City Athletics. And he managed and coached a number of those different teams that I mentioned before. So what I'd like to do in terms of my own remarks here, I think I've got, I do a lot of presentations. This is at the old Capitol in Iowa City. A few years back, we had a two-day baseball symposium, and I had part of my collection on display. And Bob Feller, of course, one of the seven Hall of Famers from Iowa. The seven Hall of Famers from Iowa were Cap Anson, Dave Bancroft, Fred Clark, Urban Faber, Bob Feller, Dazzy Vance, and Dale Wilkins. And I'm trying to drum that into the heads of all Iowans so they know that and appreciate that. And I'm having some success. I'm getting around. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to finish my remarks with just a couple of quotes. And one was from McVay himself near the end of his career. Like I said, he'd been around baseball for 41 years. And as he was retiring, this is with the San Jose Dukes, player manager, he said, "I withdrew from baseball, but my heart has always been with the boys on the diamond." And then someone who whose name was mentioned earlier in a tribute to the winners of the David's Award and so on, Fred Ira Campbell, who had done a lot of early research on Calvin McVay, said, "Cal McVay began his professional career at age 18 with the famous Cincinnati Red Sox teams of 1869 and quickly became one of the brightest lights in the game in the first decades of openly professional play." And I'll stop there. I'm glad to try and answer a few questions. Thank you very much.
Iowa's first governor.
Kirkwood was the governor during the Civil War, and he played an important role in it. His name is Ansel Graves. And, you know, I did this kind of a stunt with my students, but there was a serious side to it. And we don't teach and respect our own regional history or local history enough. And, you know, I would ask him at the same time, can you name the first president? Of course, that was a joke. But why don't you know your governor? Robert Lucas was the first territorial governor. But his name is Ansel Graves. He lived in New Hampshire, moved to Iowa, and so on. Let's get back to baseball.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
It's all right. No.
Speaking of Iowa here, sorry, I'm a little taller than this. Did Cal McVay ever end up going back to Iowa other than just playing appearances and all that? Did he ever come back for anything else?
Everything that I found in my research, after the family moved to Indianapolis, there were only two times that he ever came back to Iowa. And I mentioned one of them already. And that was, you know, when he was playing for Boston, and they came back to play against the Keokuk Westerns in 1875. And the sad thing is that the local newspapers didn't even bring up that here that one of the best players in America is back playing in a ballgame. And it was just, and that season, if you know much about the American Association, the Keokuk Westerns were the fringe, they were the far west. They, after a 1-12 season, they folded. The gate was horrible, very few people came to the games, they played at a place called Perry Park and so on. And the Red Stockings were supposed to play three games against them. After the first game, which the Red Stockings won easily, they snuck out of their hotel in the middle of the night to come back to Chicago and forfeit the game. And then the Keokuk Westerns folded. The only other time that we know that Calvin McRae came to Iowa is after they had won those first games in 1869 and came back to Cincinnati for that banquet. They went to Omaha to catch the train. McVeigh rode on as a professional team, the first professional team, to ride on the first transcontinental railroad, which had been completed on May 10th of 1869. But they went to Omaha, and the Omaha team wanted to play a game against them, but they were scheduled to play in San Francisco, but they promised they would play when they came back. And there is a description of their taking a stagecoach from out of, I think, the St. Joe, Missouri area, up to Council Bluffs, Iowa, and they actually did cross a part of Iowa. And I think there's a description of those, the entire Red Sox team in the stagecoach bouncing along, singing, you know, a couple of them up on top, a couple hanging out the windows and so on. But that's it. After that, there are no accounts of this ever coming back here, or back to Iowa. Yes?
Yeah. Hi, I just wanted to ask, when you talked about big crowds going to biggest crowd at a professional baseball game or anything.
In the West.
In the West. No, I realize that. Were there any other sporting attraction options available to the general public in those days, or was baseball pretty much it?
Oh, there were. Horse racing was huge. Wrestling, boxing were huge. There's kind of a funny anecdote when they came back to the San Francisco area. You know, after beating those teams soundly out there, they did play a game in Omaha, and in the audience was Scott Colfax, the vice president. And the score was so lopsided, I don't remember the exact score, but it was something like 44-4 after two or three innings. And a dogfight broke out just off to the side of the ball field, and the gamblers all started betting on the dogfight. But there were other popular sports. If you look at Porter's Spirit at the Times, and, you know, there are just a lot of other, you know, sports that were going on at the time, so you did have a lot of other options in terms of entertainment. When I did the research on the origins of baseball in Iowa, I had to read, you know, the primary source accounts of newspapers from the 1850s, and what I was reading about was I was reading about cricket was in Iowa before baseball. You know, boxing, horse races, foot races, those were all there. And what you would read about is cricket, cricket, cricket. And then finally, on June 28th of 1858, a group of young men were called to the home of the local judge in Davenport, Iowa. And that's the first account of an organized team in Iowa baseball history. Very few accounts before the Civil War, and of course, put on delay, very few during the Civil War. And one statistic I'd like to throw out, I know that I've been working a little bit with the Spread of Baseball project that Sabre's involved with, but in 1866, there were fewer than 10 town teams in Iowa. The next, Des Moines, the capital, had one of the capital cities. In 1867, there were 200 town teams in Iowa. That's from 10 to 200.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Jeff. First of all, delighted that you wore the uniform. I was hoping you would do that.
What's that?
Delighted you wore the uniform.
I think
you would do that.
Second question.
No, so the uniform, her name was Bertha Bertram. And Harry Wright contracted with her, okay, to make these uniforms. The material's called cricket flannel. This is an exact replica uniform, except for my Nikes, okay? And the hat is down there on the stage, it's one of two styles. And my boots, they're up in the room. There were two different styles, at least of boots. One was for colder weather and so on, and one breathed more, and they would lace up, come up above your ankle and so on. But, you know, it's nice today, it's cool here in Chicago and so on, but I've given some programs in small-town libraries where the air conditioning didn't work. And in August, yeah, you know, I'm just soaked. And I can't imagine playing a five-hour game or a three-hour game wearing this stuff. They did, all right? But I think the whole idea was, if you're going to have a professional team, you need to look professional. And that was the idea. We're going to have rules. That's what, you know, Harry Wright said. We're going to have curfews. They had problems. That's one of the reasons in the second season the Red Sox can split up. Is because Wright and Gould, the two Wright brothers, Gould and McVeigh, were, if not teetotalers, rarely imbibed. The others loved to gamble, carouse, stay out late, and that caused problems. When they set off on an opening tour, a couple of them were drunk. They had to borrow money from one of the wives to get money to go out on the opening tour, and so on. So it was hard to keep that group together. The age range, they were young kids. Except for Harry Wright and Asa Brainard, all of them were 23 or younger. And so, you know, it's to keep those guys in tow wasn't easy. So, but anyway, that's the uniform, and I enjoy it. It's kind of a tribute to, you know, Iowa's first professional player.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have, guys. We got to clear out for the other one. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry, I hate to cut off questions. You know, the question is...